From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the summer of 2010 when heavy monsoon rains flooded parts of Pakistan. In one photograph, a man clings desperately to the rope from what looks like the side of a boat. Floodwaters have nearly covered him. His eyes are closed, and this remarkable image offers a look at both the fatal flooding and the human will to survive. Roughly one-fifth of Pakistan's total land area was flooded, a devastating and historic event, and the world saw images captured by photojournalists, including Paula Bronstein, whose work would be nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. This week, Bronstein is back in Rochester, one of four RIT alumni, I should say, who've been nominated or awarded Pulitzer Prizes, who will speak to students and the community this week. Throughout their careers, they have seen newsrooms repeatedly cut budgets and staffs. Photojournalism is not always spared in rounds of cuts. What does this mean for the future of journalism? Today and tomorrow, you'll meet these award-winning photojournalists and we'll hear their perspectives about the work they've done and the value of their profession. And our guests this hour include Paula Bronstein, a photojournalist whose work in 2011 was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in the breaking news photography category, and now freelance. Is that correct, Paula?
Yes, that's correct.
Is that a happy current reality for you?
It can be wonderful and it can be difficult, challenging, both financially, business-wise, you know. Being staff for 80% of my career, it's not like I jumped into freelance knowing everything that would be involved.
Well, thanks for being here. It's great
to
have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Also here is David Carson, a photojournalist who was a 2015 Pulitzer Prize winner in the breaking news photography category. David, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Where is home and work for you now? Tell our listeners.
I live in St. Louis Post.
You sort of feel live in the St. Louis Post, I suspect.
I do. You know, I spend enough hours there in a given week. But I live in St. Louis, but I'm a Boston native. So I find myself in the unusual position of being a Red Sox fan in Cardinals territory.
Oh, very strange. Well, thank you for being here. And also with us is William Snyder, a four-time Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer, chair of the photojournalism program at RIT, who has helped put this week together. Welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Great to be back, Evan.
Tell us what's coming up here, and there's a lot happening this week. What's on the list here?
Okay, well, we've got a bunch of great events, both public and for the students. So just in general, what we're trying to do is get these four folks in front of as many students as we possibly can, especially students that aren't necessarily in photography, to understand what it is that they do for a living and how the process works. And then we're going to have three public events that I hope your listeners will pick one or even more to come to and to enjoy. So tonight at 6 o'clock at the Magic Spell Studios, Wegman Theater, on the RIT campus, there will be a panel discussion with them. They're going to give a brief history of their work, and then we're going to do a lot of question and answers, both from myself and hopefully from the public. Tomorrow, there will be, at 5:30, there will be a public program down at the RIT City Art Space, which is at 280 East Main Street on the first floor of the Sibley Tower. And again, the public is invited for that, and they're going to show some of their work, and then we're going to talk about a lot of different things pertaining to their work and to their profession. And then on Friday at 2 o'clock, again back at the Magic Spell Studios Wegman Theater, there will be a symposium with them and several faculty members from the College of Liberal Arts, and they're going to talk about the science, the art, the craft, and ethics of researching and producing and disseminating all their stories. And so that's from 2 to 3:30, again, at the Magic Spell Studios Wegman Theater. So hopefully a lot of your listeners can come to any or all of those.
Okay, and before the hour is over, I'll make sure William repeats that list for you here. We're talking to Pulitzer Prize nominees and winners, and it is a remarkable panel of people who have seen the industry change. And before this hour began, there was a sort of a brewing dialogue at the table about what those changes have meant. And, you know, David Carson, I saw an interview that you gave with Pointer online in which you talked about that. And at one point they asked you, you know, in the course of your career, how has journalism changed for the better? And your response was, you know, I think I want to hear what my colleagues have to say about that. It's hard to think of something. You know, it's tough, huh?
Yeah, you know, corporate ownership of media in America has turned out to be, you know, disastrous for communities and keeping them informed. There have been round after round of cuts in newsrooms. And, you know, and this isn't because newspapers aren't profitable. This is because, you know, we're, you know, we're still making money, but the problem is that we've lost a lot of our advertising revenue over the years, and that will necessitate a smaller staff. But the amount of cuts to newsrooms that have happened have been outsized compared to that reduction in revenue.
All right, so let me at least take the corporate ownership perspective when they say, you're right, ad revenue has fallen, so it is less profitable and sometimes not profitable. But you say it is still profitable.
You know, I should preface this with the fact that I am the vice president of my union in St. Louis, and so I have a very worker standpoint on this. But, you know, my company, Lee Enterprises, has paid back $1.2 billion to the banks in the last 12 years. And so, you know, that's $1.2 billion that could have been invested in journalism or something else. Even if it was only $100 million that they reinvested in journalism, our paper would be in a stronger position. If that money was invested back into the community and journalism. But, you know, I support our paper, and, you know, I believe that we are still the best. I believe that newspapers around the country are still the best source of local news information. They still, as a whole, newspapers still employ the largest staffs of news reporters and gatherers in their communities.
Paula, do you agree with David that corporate ownership has been a disaster in this country?
I certainly agree. I mean, I was laid off in 2013, and that was strictly a corporate restructuring. I think that's quite a common phrase, restructuring, which ends up in layoffs, buyouts, any number of things, you know.
The late George Carlin would have had fun saying, oh, restructuring is what you want to call it. How many syllables do you need when I got restructured? I got fired. You know, one syllable versus how many?
And then we have newspapers and news.
Fired is not fair. Laid off, but go ahead.
Yeah, but we have. It's not just newspapers. It's news agencies. You know, wire services. You know, I was staffed with a wire service before. You know, after being staffed with a few different newspapers in the U.S. But the point is, it's affected. I think it's affected the type of coverage these days, especially there's only a handful of newspapers in the country now that have budgets to really do investigative work and travel budgets as well. You know, obviously, we know the New York Times, Washington Post, you know, and I have friends that work in Sacramento, and they're the last two staff standing. The layoffs have been slow. It's been like an ongoing cancer. It's just continued. And then you end up with who's still afloat, you know, who hasn't been forced to jump ship. It's incredible when I've known friends for years, you know, and I worked at the Hartford Courant for 12 years. I don't know anybody that's still working there anymore. And I have dear friends that still live in Connecticut, and I go back there whenever I'm in the States. I don't know anybody. It's sad but true, yeah.
I would say, from my perspective in public radio, we're very pleased and confident with this model because of there's so much turmoil, so much tumult in how anything gets funded and paid for, that we feel that this is a really good model. But I am curious to know if both of you have a view that, well, if corporate ownership of newspapers, of newsrooms, has been a disaster, what's a model that would have been better?
You know, that's a good question. I think if Paula was talking about the Washington Post, so you have a billionaire owner at the Washington Post, you have a billionaire owner at the Boston Globe, you have a billionaire owner up in Minnesota at the Minneapolis Star Tribune. That seems to be a model right now that is working. And fortunately, most of these billionaires are keeping their thumbs and hands out of the news operations, it seems like. The problem would be is if you have a billionaire owner who wanted to really, you know, slant that news coverage. So I'm not sure if I think the billionaire owners that we have right now that can sustain some of these losses in papers are you know, kind of working out well. The growth of the Washington Post and that digital expertise that Bezos brought there was pretty great.
LA Times?
LA Times. I was a billionaire owner. Mm-hmm. And you know, there you saw the workers forming a union that almost forced that sale. They were about to be gutted. They were going to lay off, I think, about 100 people from their staff or so like that, and they forced a sale from the Tribune Company to this new billionaire local owner and stuff. I think that local ownership is actually the best model. When you have a local ownership who is invested in the community and civically minded and wants his community covered, I think that that's going to produce the best results.
Yeah. Now, William, can I ask you, you've been at a number of different places around the country as well before being right here at in Rochester. So do you agree with this notion that corporate ownership has been largely a disaster?
Oh, yes. The short version is yes. As I was having a discussion, I was at a big thing a couple of weeks ago with people in our industry. And the big question becomes, what is the most important thing, profits or the mission of journalism? And clearly, it's, with a couple of exceptions that have been mentioned, it's all about profit. And, you know, I could go off on a long rant, which I will refrain from, about, you know, the idea of corporations now are about ever-growing profits. Not a good, solid profit like it was when I was a kid. And, you know, blue-chip companies, they turned a really good profit every year. You know, sometimes it was higher, sometimes it was lower. They paid a really solid dividend, and they were really good. Well, that's all gone out the window, and so there's this ever, you know, this avaricious hunger for more and more and more and more, and you just can't do it. And it really bothers me. I take journalism, in general, and photojournalism in particular, very, very seriously. I think it's something that's really important for this country. The founding fathers obviously did too. It's right there in the first, you know, in the First Amendment. And we're seeing now that without really serious journalism, there are a lot of things that are going on that, you know, that are harming this country in a multitude of ways. The most recent thing is, you know, everybody's starting to question now what's going on with the FAA after the Boeing incidents. And, you know, I see this as part of the problem. If you don't have a watchdog watching corporate America and you don't have them watching the government, the entire country suffers. And we see it all over the world. So
in Seattle and in some other places, some remarkable reporting has helped illuminate exactly who knew what and what the problems were. But you're right. Without that, can we imagine what the consequences are?
Well, I mean, it's just awful. I mean, the short version is, it's like the notion of, okay, we're beginning to find out that Boeing was responsible for okaying itself, is the short version, you know, the black and white version of what happened, as opposed to the FAA, you know, really looking over them. And why was that? That was because the FAA didn't have the money or the expertise to do it. Well, that sounds sort of familiar when it comes to journalism. If you don't have the money and the expertise in journalism to oversee what's going on, bad things happen.
Well, let's talk to our guests. And again, this week, today, tomorrow, you've got Pulitzer Prize finalists, Pulitzer Prize winners here, RIT alumni back here in Rochester and talking to students, talking to the community about the work they've done. The New York Times noting that Paula Bronstein can't stop going back to Afghanistan. You've traveled quite a bit for work. You've got a smile on your face because I imagine that there's the work is not easy, but there is some affinity with certain. Are there certain projects or stories or ongoing themes that draw you back?
Well, in terms of Afghanistan, I went in early December 2001, along with a lot of other media at the time after 9/11. After 9/11, I was not in New York. I was sent to Pakistan. And from Pakistan, slowly, when it was safe, finally went into Afghanistan for the first time. And then for Getty Images, I was sort of it was more or less my beat. So I did go back a number of times over the years, even during the time, you know, with the Iraq War when we kind of forgot about it. And so for me, and then I finally came out with a book highlighting kind of, you know, Afghans living against a backdrop of war and conflict. That was about 16 years worth of work, and that came out 2.5 years ago.
Which you can get this week in Rochester in an acclaimed book.
Yes, Afghanistan Between Hope and Fear.
Yeah. Yesterday on this program, we met a man by the name of Bashir Qayyum, who is an Afghan who is now living in Rochester with his family, came just 2 months ago. And he worked with the U.S. military as an interpreter and finally was able to come to the United States and is hoping to build a life here. And what he told us on this program yesterday, and I would just urge our listeners, if you missed it, it's one of the really powerful conversations I can remember in a long time. He says it's the first time in his life when he goes to bed at night, he does not leave the light on wondering if a bomb is going to hit his house or if someone is going to try to enter the home and try to kill him. So he said, this is peace for the first time. He has never understood walking down a street entirely free of fear or suspicious. And that peace at night, it was really amazing stuff. So for those of us who haven't been there, it's one thing to go and report. It's another to bring the images. What if you try, what are the stories that you have felt, not only, boy, this is a remarkable image, this is a compelling image, but this tells a story that maybe people don't fully understand about Afghanistan?
Yeah, well, I mean, now we're in our 17th year. Nobody can really understand how we got there, you know, America's longest war, and why, and all the troops that have been killed, maimed, you know, who have really, really, I mean, and I have to say I have a tremendous empathy for the translators that worked for the military. Mm-hmm. I know what they did personally, and the translators that worked for us, the media, they took a lot of risks. Yes, it was good money for them at the time, but then if the Taliban are, causing them tremendous security issues and they're trying to leave the country, I can't even imagine how long it took this particular man that you just spoke with mm-hmm. yesterday, how many years it took him to get here, how long he was waiting for that U.S. visa. It's been tough for these guys, and I know it. And I felt, you know, so I have a lot of empathy for them, the ones that make it. And, of course, under the Trump administration, it's even more difficult for them to get their special visas to this country.
What are some of the images that not only will we find in your book, but that maybe stay in your mind above others that help tell a story of Afghanistan?
Well, a lot of what I did over the years was a number. I did a lot of feature stories, you know, so I really was trying to show not just the news images. I mean, I did cover elections. I covered the aftermath of suicide bombings. Mm-hmm. I mean, I covered some really horrific stuff, did extensive stories on the war wounded. And I think it was the war wounded, for me, in other words, the civilian casualties, that impacted me the most, because I felt like they are off the news within 24 hours. So let's say another bombing happens in Kabul. That is in the news for a very short period of time, and then it's gone. And but those families are impacted, the loved ones that are lost, you know, if a young woman becomes an amputee, her life is very, very difficult, if not over, because she maybe cannot produce children. You know, it goes on and on, and like we don't have time to get into that. But for me, it was highlighting those people, those silent victims, that was very important to me, because I wanted to tell the world, who are these people?
Yeah, and there's a real touch involved when you are documenting that kind of tragedy, that kind of personal loss, in a way that, I know you don't want anyone to ever feel exploited. Mm-hmm. How do you navigate those difficult moments? And then I'm curious to know the personal toll it may take on you. It must be difficult.
Yeah, it's been difficult over the years. I'll be quite honest about that. But that's because if you see a lot of death and destruction, whether it's war and conflict or natural disasters. And because I've been based in Asia for 2 decades, I've covered a lot of earthquakes, floods in Pakistan, et cetera, et cetera. And just covering these horrific events is difficult. Witnessing death is not easy, and trying to be sympathetic to the people you photograph and feel like you're making a difference is very important to me whenever I can do it. I mean, when I covered the Rohingya crisis in 2017, I covered it for 2 months, but then at the end of it, I got an assignment from a UK newspaper that I work for frequently, and it was a Christmas appeal. And we, through this Christmas appeal, we were able to raise over £1 million British that went directly to the Rohingya through Save the Children. So it's times like that when I go, wow, I've been able to do something. And it's making a difference, you know. But sometimes, you know, in Afghanistan, you do these stories and people write you and email you, how can we, you know, how can we donate money and blah, blah, blah. That's tough. That's tough because it has to be through an NGO. It has to be through a UN agency.
Yeah. And by now, I'm sure your friends and family have understood that this is who you are and what you do. But how many times have you heard them say over the years, you know, we're worried about you?
Yeah, that's... It's as you can imagine, because I've always been going off to places that they've never traveled to or barely understand. In a way, I should say, I mean, especially with my father, he's always been looking on a map and seeing where I am and really trying to understand more and then looking at my photographs. And through my photos, he has been able to understand a lot more about some important issues.
Sure.
Yeah.
And now when you're talking to students, whether it's at RIT or elsewhere, to the extent that we will have newsrooms that want to send people around the world, or at least hire freelance, whatever the case may be, what advice do you give them when it comes to sort of intelligently navigating volatile zones, spots, war?
Mm.
How do you help them understand how to do the job, to do it well, to do it safely?
Mm. Well, it's really important to do it safely, number one. Freelancers these days may want to jump into Iraq or whatever. You know, I mean, I know quite a few were trying to cover Mosul at the time, at the height of that war. Now, the problem is, how do you do it safely? And how do you have the money if fixers are going for upwards of $500 a day? Freelancers don't have that kind of money. They have to be on assignment. But again, I have to get back to doing it safely. So that means, you know, there's all sorts of courses they can take that a lot of them are being offered free these days to freelance journalists so that they learn what to do, what not to do, you know, because you have to go in with protective gear. You just can't. It's very, very important. You can't just sort of jump into any conflict zone with a high threat level without some knowledge of how to work there.
And now, as someone I said off the top of the hour, you know, I wonder if it's a happy situation where you're a freelancer, only because that doesn't mean waiting every 6 months and wondering if when the next axe falls in a newsroom. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about income and work. So how does it work for you? How does it happen? How does work either come to you or for you to go to it?
I try to balance between applying for grants so that I'm doing stories that I'm really passionate about. And then, of course, the assignments that come in. Some of them are incredibly interesting. Some of them are more mundane, which is only natural. Salary-wise, it's very different when you're a staff photographer, because the longer you are part of that staff, the higher your salary. Unfortunately, with freelancing, whether you have 5 years in the business or 35, you're getting the same day rate. And that's not going to change. And then you have, you know, both wire services and newspapers that haven't increased their day rate in many years. But yet we have to buy new equipment, new computers, and so it's always a financial challenge.
Where are you going next, do you know?
I'm going to Nepal next to do a story on yaks. For
yaks?
Yes. I'm quite excited about it.
I wonder if the lacks are yes so, less so.
What's the story? For listeners that are not familiar with yaks, they're basically... high-altitude cows.
I mean, they are.
They only live above 10,000 feet.
And what's the story?
They can't survive below that altitude.
What's
so the story is obviously to trek into some of these communities and document families who, you know, it's actually, families that raise yaks because they're making cheese, just as, you know, cow farmers are the same. It's the same. You know, you've got meat, you've got dairy coming, and then you've got the hide as well that is quite profitable for some of these families living in rural areas of Nepal. So that's what I'm going to cover.
What young photojournalists wouldn't want in jobs like this? The work, the interest, the wide range of ideas, issues, subjects and stories and images to cover. Paula Bronstein is a photojournalist who was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2011. After our only break of the hour, we're going to talk to David Carson about his work. We're going to have all three of our guests brawl a little bit about whether they're content with sort of the evolution and state of change or if it's a problem. I'm going to stake out the ground that I'm not thrilled about what's happened in journalism, but we all believe in it very deeply, and that's part of why they're here, talking to students, talking to our community, both at RIT and all around Rochester this week. Let's take that break and come right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about what draws people to water. The city of Rochester is in the midst of the multi-million dollar Rock the Riverway project. It's aimed at revitalizing riverfront spots and bringing people down to riverfront locations. But what is it that works? What are examples of other cities that are getting it right? The Community Design Center and the Reshaping of Rochester series brings in a guest who can talk all about that next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. We've got Pulitzer Prize finalists, winners with us in studio. You just heard Paula Bronstein. David Carson is a photojournalist who was a 2015 Pulitzer Prize winner in breaking news photography. St. Louis Post and someone who is not far from Ferguson, Missouri. Tell me what your first recollections were when things were happening there.
Well, you know, that's a great question. And I think it's interesting to have both Paul and I here because Paul's events are happening around the world and my events were happening 10 miles from my front door of my house. And so, you know, when I first heard about Ferguson, it was when I got a tweet when I was standing in Target doing back-to-school shopping with my daughter. And this tweet was from someone I had begun following years earlier on Twitter because I thought he had something interesting to say up in this area of St. Louis where I didn't have a lot of contacts. And I kind of used Twitter as a listening post throughout my community to listen to, you know, what people were saying. And I started following this guy, and then he proceeded to spend the next 2 years flirting with women on Twitter, and I almost unfollowed him a number of times. But he was the first person who said, hey, you need to look at this. And it was a picture of Michael Brown's stepfather holding a sign that's saying, police just executed my son. And so I'm standing in Target, and I was like, okay. And, you know, I wasn't working that day, and so I called their city desk and let them know what was going on there. And, you know, talked to our photographer that was on duty that day, and he got up there. And I started to see more and more stuff on Twitter taking place of this shooting in Ferguson. And I talked to our photographer who had now arrived up there on scene. He said, yeah, why don't you come on up? And that was the beginning of what's probably going to be the biggest story of my career.
How quickly did you know how big it was going to be?
You know, in the first 2 days, I kept thinking, in the first 2 days of the protests or after the shooting, this looked to me like every other police shooting I had covered previously. And St. Louis has about 10 to 12 fatal police officer-involved shootings a year. We've had two in the last week in St. Louis. So I had covered a number of these fatal police officer-involved shootings in St. Louis over the years, and so I wasn't... This to me looks sort of similar, where there was a community outrage and stuff, but it would typically die down, and the police would circle the wagons and not give out a lot of information. But what was taking place that was different here in Ferguson was that there was an entire narrative developing on Twitter, in social media about what had taken place, and that was really feeding the community outrage, and that you know, more people turned out because they were turned out on the streets because they saw what was happening on social media or what was reported to be happening on social media. And that led to just more and more conflicts with the police. And then things began to spiral out of control.
You end up as a Pulitzer Prize winner for some of the work there. But I'm wondering just sort of the toll, you know, maybe on you and the staff, and you're sort of the human approach to trying to understand, to try to grapple with just the scale of it. This was one event, but it became a national story, and it became a national story because The maybe strange thing about the Michael Brown case is in some communities, a lot of the details matter, but they don't matter as much as the symbolic nature of what has happened in a lot of different cities. How do you approach it? How do you try to tell that story? And at the time, are you thinking, I'm covering this event in the narrow sense, or this is an event that is touching our entire country, and that's what this story is?
You know, to try to put all that in the context is, you know, what we're trying to do on the ground there. And when you're standing in the middle of protesters and there's a line of police and riot gear lined up there and they start firing tear gas, and to try to keep all that in perspective and try to keep the best picture, to keep the big picture of it, I don't know if you're really aware of it while you're doing it as much as you are responding to a rapidly evolving situation and trying to maintain your safety and think about, okay, where do I need to be and where can I not be and stuff. I mean, I used a lot of my hostile environment training from Afghanistan and Iraq and while I was in Ferguson. How am I going to stay safe? I often nights wore a bulletproof vest and a ballistic helmet and had a gas mask on my leg. So, you know, it was interesting, you know, to be employing these personal safety tactics 10 miles from my front door. And, you know, this wasn't happening 1,000 miles away. This was, you know, right out, you know, these were people I knew. I knew some of the police officers. I knew some of the protesters. And my job was to accurately report what was going on there and you know, kind of to create a historical record of this, of these events.
And some of the emotion, some of the pain captured in your work is so visceral. And I want to ask you, David, about how you make sure that if you capture an image, you are confident that it conveys accurately, not just one brief little moment or, you know, sort of something that's mildly out of context, but yes, the visceral nature of this image is what is happening here. How do you make that determination?
You know, I think that if you can look at the picture and you feel like it's a true and accurate representation of what you experienced out there, that's great. Now, the problem with still photographs is that the viewer is going to bring in a whole different set of personal biases and experiences to your photograph. And that's where I think the job of a photojournalist is. I think the captions are very important with pictures because they put the pictures in the context of what you're seeing there and stuff, as opposed to just having a picture there and leaving it to be interpreted by someone. The caption is really what the journalism is in photojournalism, where we're telling people this is what you're seeing and this is the context of that.
Yeah, I have an image of my 6-year-old son jumping up to catch a baseball. My goodness, when I looked at the picture I took of myself, when I went, oh, this kid looks like a major league outfielder. His legs are spread, his glove is outstretched. It looks like it is a sprawling, leaping, amazing catch. But because of the way this picture is taken, you can also see the live portion of the video. It is the least impressive catch I've ever seen. But the image made it look like the most athletic thing you've ever seen. And I thought, I think I'll keep this, and I will be the only one who knows that really it wasn't that impressive because the singular image made it look a certain way. I am certain that the Fergusons and incidents like this, you know, that's not the case. But day to day, I want to know your technique for saying, hey, let's capture this. What are we looking for? What are we looking for in a scene that says, this is the story, I'm in the right place, this is where I need to be, this is what I need to be pointed at here?
Yeah, you know, when I'm out on a scene and I'm working a situation, you're trying to simplify a lot of times because there's so much going on. And in a photograph, if you include everything, you're not giving anyone anything specific to look at. And so I'm looking for emotion and interaction and, visual framing of the picture that's going to help people understand what they're seeing at. And then I backed it up with a caption to, you know, explain it.
Can I ask you just in terms of the, you know, years after, what is it, almost 5 years post-Ferguson?
Yeah, we're coming
now?
Up on 5 years.
5 years. You know, similar to Paula's point that there can be a bombing in Kabul. You can have an entire neighborhood impacted and families lost and children lost. And then within hours, most of the world has already moved on. You know, the world moves on from massive national stories here pretty quickly. And I don't think a lot of people have thought too much about, well, how things have improved, how are the relationships, what are the relationships like? Because the story, as we know, if Ferguson became even bigger than that, the DOJ report, the sort of the broken taillight policing and all of those stories, what's the relationships like there now?
So You know, that's an interesting question. There's definitely more conversations taking place about what, how police interact with their communities and how they're policed. We in St. Louis had done a series of stories 10 years before Ferguson called Law and Disorder, where we looked at the balkanization of the St. Louis municipal structure and all these little tiny municipalities that had police forces, and how really these police forces were really just serving as profit centers for their for these small municipalities. Some of these municipalities are less than a square mile, and they would have their own police force, and they'd be out running radar traps. And so this creates a lot of negative interactions with the community. And then, you know, so you'd get pulled over and get this ticket for, you know, running a red light or something, and then the person may not have any money to pay off that debt. And so you get essentially what are debtor prisons. And, you know, this was all playing into the policing of St. Louis. And this is where we had this problem, is this is why it blew up. And because people had finally had enough, and the shooting of Michael Brown was the straw that set it all off.
Do you sense in 2019 that something like that could happen again?
I think we're always in St. Louis one officer-involved shooting away from things getting serious. We had in 2017, we had a large protest after an officer was acquitted of murder from an officer-involved shooting. And it was really a lot of the same people taking back to the streets. And I think you see it echoed across the country as well. You know, one of the fascinating things about Ferguson was seeing how it grew from being a local story to a national story to an international story, and how the shooting of Michael Brown breathed life into the Black Lives Matter movement. Black Lives Matter had been a hashtag that started on Twitter during why am I drawing a blank on his name right now? During the shooting of the 13-year-old
Trayvon Martin
in Florida, had started back during that. But it wasn't until the death of Michael Brown that really breathed life into that movement, and then it took on a life of its own.
I confess I was hoping to hear you say, you know what, there's been so much progress, so much change. But it sounds like, I don't hear you saying anything is imminent, but to hear you say you feel like you're always one incident away from wondering if it could happen again.
You know,
it's tough.
So there was the Ferguson Commission report, and the Ferguson Commission published a report last year that showed progress in a number of things. I think there was a 40-something point plan that they laid out from that report, and they're showing progress in some things. On a day-to-day interaction, when I'm out there on the street level, there's still a lot of distrust between the community and the police both ways there and stuff. So it's something that I think a lot of communities across the country are struggling with, is how are we going to get the police and the community to trust them, each other, to make our communities better.
Pointer Online asked you, what are you doing now that you didn't expect to be doing 10 years ago? Your answer was using a cell phone as a multifunction tool to cover stories, which you have done this hour, taking pictures around the room. And so is Paul. I'm looking around the room, and you're using your phones to take pictures, which so let's talk a little bit about how that's changed. And you also said that one thing that's changed is you have embraced social media in a way that you didn't early on, and that you tell students now, you know, don't be a curmudgeon about it, that there's a lot of good here. So why do you say that?
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, Ferguson was really a major part of my full embrace of social media. I had played on social media before that, and had a small following. But because Ferguson was happening on social media and I was out there doing good reporting, I saw the ability of my work being amplified out there by so many other people. And it was amazing to see it spread like that. And I think that the work of my coworkers and myself on social media really helped build our case for our entry in the Pulitzer Prizes there, because it raised the awareness of this local paper's coverage of these events. Because one of the things that was, interesting when we were out there was that, you know, when the national media and the international media, you know, Al Jazeera and BBC descended on the city, you know, it was like, oh my, you know, the satellite truck showed up, and, you know, how was our community then interacting with it? And the other thing is that, you know, the satellite trucks were long gone after 2 weeks, and we were still on the ground and covering the story, and we continue to cover the story. And so that's one of the things that I think is really the value of local journalism is the long-term staying power of it to cover stories long-term.
But do you worry that the immediacy of social media is such a temptation that we can, and I say we, I mean the universal society, not just journalists, can get things wrong and can do harm?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, absolutely, you can see things done misrepresented on social media or misunderstood on social media. Even during Ferguson, we were having a problem where, you know, people were putting out tweets and you would be like, that's not true. I'm standing right here. Mm-hmm. But you would see it echoed and you would see these fallacies echoed for
weeks. And they gained velocity very quickly.
Correct. And so it doesn't have to be... And I think that that's, you know, part of media literacy and having people understand, like, who are their sources of information and stuff. And people talk about fake news, and there is a lot of fake news out there. But as a rule of thumb, they're not, you know, they're not newspaper reporters. The newspaper reporters are pretty straightforward and interested in covering their communities. So, you know, look who your sources are. What's the source of it?
Well, let's ask all of our guests to kind of pick up some of the thread that William Snyder was provoking before the hour began, which is, you know, the change that has come that David touched on in his conversation with Poynter, using cell phones as multifunction tools, looking at the way newsrooms have changed, the way the job of a photojournalist has changed, the constant churn of content, not just the images for a story, but also how are you feeding the web, how are you updating social media. You know, William was kind of, I don't know. Why don't you speak for yourself? I was a little surprised to hear you say, well, it's not bad, it's just changing. And my point was, I think it's a little bit of a negative.
Well, I mean, my point is this. We are in a, I said earlier, corporate ownership has been a bad thing for journalism. But I think we are also in a time period where journalism is going through massive changes. It's becoming fractured, unlike it's ever been in the past. What I always like to say to everybody is there's not 100 organizations that hire, you know, as far as photojournalists concerned, you know, 50 people. There's, you know, there's 1,000 of them hiring one. I think that bodes well in the long run. I also think that the current administration has sparked so much interest in journalism and getting people active in the community that we're seeing something of a resurgence in the interest in it. Now, it may not help in some places, but the New York Times is healthier than they've been in a while. The Washington Post, you can think what you want of Bezos. But they're doing very, very good work, and they're economically healthy besides the fact that he's pumped money in there. L.A. Times, which you were talking about. You know, I brought up in our prior conversation ProPublica, and there are other places, even BuzzFeed, you know, that sort of goofy website has a solid journalism portion of what they're doing. And you know, it's happening. What I find really interesting, and I don't know if anybody saw this, but yesterday, I've lost track of time, Facebook said that their model's not working because there's not enough local news.
Yes, exactly.
And so, you know, this is one of the things that I've always said, okay, Facebook, put your money where your mouth is. You need to invest in local news somehow instead of just sucking everything out of it.
Man lights lawn on fire and is upset there's no grass the next day.
Exactly. Right. And so, you know, I have hopes. I don't think we're dying. We're just changing. And I think one of the things that's going to happen too is that what we do, especially as photojournalists, it's going to become more important, and the skill set is going to become more than just the ability to take a picture. And we're beginning to see it. As more and more people get into this business, the idea is you can't just take pictures, because with the advent of the iPhone, everybody can take pictures, and with, you know, Sony, Canon, Nikon technology, everybody can take good quality pictures. But to tell a story, to tell a really good story, takes a lot of talent and a lot of training. And I think that's the difference. And I get the sense that the public wants this. And the reason that I say that is because think about documentaries. as recently as 10 years ago, you rarely heard about documentaries. I mean, they were out there and they were sort of, you know, this sort of elite little group of films that people made. Now, everybody goes out and sees them. They're, you know, and all of these media companies are investing in documentaries. People want to see real stories about real people. And that's why I say this thing is evolving. It may not be quite the way that we think of it now, but people want stories about real life that are told as honestly as humanly possible. There are people that want to argue that there is no such thing as pure objectivity. Well, yeah, of course not. But you still want a story that has some quote-unquote truth to it. And so that's why I think we're just evolving, we're changing. What is it going to be? I don't know. I'm an old guy. It's for the generation of students that I'm teaching and that have come through in the last few years. And even, you know, I mean, David is still young enough. Paul is young enough, you know, to evolve what we're doing. And so that's why I have hope. I'm not saying it's not bad, but I have hope.
Okay.
I think we live in a more visual world now than ever. You know, the problem is getting people to value those images.
That's the thing, David. See, we have this access to visual, but everybody thinks they're, you know, a professional or their images are great. That I don't need to hire a photographer, whether it's for someone's wedding portraits or for the Dallas Morning News or whatever the case may be. And if you think that you don't need that, my concern is your professional work is much above and beyond, and I don't want the world thinking that everyone's an expert here.
Yeah, but I would argue the exact opposite.
Just because I invoked your former employer?
No.
Oh.
Because, you know, I use weddings as an example of where people have evolved and learned. They figured out that, you know, just using an iPhone or just using a Happy Snap or whatever you want to call it is not enough anymore. That's why so many photojournalists can make a living now, because they can shoot weddings because people want a real document of their wedding.
That's
not
a very optimistic view. I know lots of wedding photographers who go, boy, I talk to a lot of people who go, well, I'm not really willing to pay X amount because, you know, I've got an iPhone.
Yeah, but I also know an awful lot of former students and an awful lot of people out there that are making good money in careers shooting weddings. Unlike they did, I never wanted to do it when I was young. I was well above that. Why would I want to shoot a wedding?
Okay.
It's all posed, you know.
And I think what we are here are visual communicators, right? You know, we're going to tell a story with a picture. And I think that's beyond just a snapshot taken with a phone is how is that, you know, if you're able to, as a photographer, to bring an eye and a vision to this, to tell a story, that's the difference. You know, it's not about the camera. It's not about your iPhone. It's about what vision and what storytelling are you doing on
but
that.
But do newsrooms value that the same way?
Well, I have to jump in the budget's always part of it, but I think they do value it. But quite often, I can't tell you how many times I get requests for photographs from nonprofits or whatever, publications that have zero budget to pay for the photos.
Right.
And I am amazed.
But we'll give you the exposure, they tell you. But we'll put your name.
Oh, yeah, but you'll get exposure. Oh, yeah.
That's what they tell journalists all the time. Can we print your work?
Right.
Now, we can't pay you, but we will put your name. That could be...
No.
It's
insulting,
isn't it? I could be a millionaire in exposure.
Yes.
Yeah, but I think as storytellers, we are valued, and those of us that have, and I just hope that those of us that have been in the business, you know, as long as we all have sitting here, that we are valued in because we have sophisticated eyes. And we really understand our subjects and how to tell stories. And that's very important.
So let me close by asking you, if a student asks you, you know, it seems like I have a passion for this, I have an eye for this, but will I have a job in this? Should I do something else? What are you going to tell them?
I think it's a longer conversation. What kind of photography are they talking about getting into?
They want to do the work that you're doing.
Yeah. And
they're inspired.
Yes, and I think it's important to inspire younger photographers. But I would say also what I've been seeing, too, is that a lot of editors are hiring younger photographers, which is great. It's great, but also, you know, for us, we want to make sure that we're not the silent generation. We want to make sure that we're also appreciated. It doesn't matter whether we don't get it, because they're not paying us anymore than they're paying that younger person.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah. We're trying to leave a good industry for this next generation here and stuff. And, you know, we're trying.
RIT is thrilled the alum are back here because they are Pulitzer Prize winning and finalist photographers. They're back here at RIT. William Snyder, oh my gosh, you got about 30 seconds. What do you want the public to know about what's happening this week?
Well, again, we have three events for them to come to. One is tonight at the Wegmans Theater on the RIT campus. And I'm looking for the information here. And it's at 6 o'clock. And then tomorrow night is at the City Space, Art Space, downtown across from Flagpole. And then again on Friday is 2 o'clock at back at the Wegmans Theater at RIT.
You should come back this week and remind us about this.
Oh, I think I'll probably do that.
Okay. All right. Well, because there are other Pulitzer Prize finalists and winners that RIT has brought back. It's a series of conversations about their work this week. I want to particularly thank Paula Bronstein and David Carson, updating us on the work they've done around the world, Ferguson, Afghanistan, and more, and your perspective and your expertise. Thank you for the work you're doing, and thanks for sharing your expertise with us this hour.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And William Snyder, see you soon.
Yes.
All right. More Connections coming up.